Welcome to the World of Horror podcast with Mom and Mac. This is the podcast where we share our love of international horror. Everyone has their fears, but we are not afraid of subtitles. Before we get into it, fair warning, these discussions will include spoilers and language which may not be suitable for all listeners. Let's move on to our first segment, Mom and Mac Chat.
Hi, Mac. How's it going?
Hi, Mom. I'm good. I'm a little bit tired. I'll try not to make this too detailed because it's boring, but 3 days out of the month for my job, I have to stay late. And today is one of those days. And I wouldn't have to. The other two is it will happen either way. But this day, it's only because we got this big report going out with a bunch of data sources and just one guy reports at like fucking 4 p.m. and it takes me forever to put it together. And I'm sending this man email after email. Hey, can you send this every month? And we even send them a calendar that's like, do you agree to send the data the day before? And everybody said, yeah, sure, we can do that. Well, why did he lie? Because he can't, and he's never done it. And then we got people, where's the report? Oh, well, one fucking asshole can't do his job. Anyways, I hate that guy. And I've tried to find him on LinkedIn, not to like talk to him, but to be like, I need to put a face to this fucking name because I hate him so much. I had to get that out.
Is his name Chad?
No, but that's pretty close.
Is there a name that even if you've never known anyone with that name, when you hear it, you're just like, that's gotta be an asshole?
I mean, yes, definitely. I try not to judge, but like, if I hear a certain, obviously we gotta get out of the way. Karen, duh. Okay, easy, low hanging fruit. But I have known some Karens. Like the name is, it matches the personality. Like, yeah. Trying to think of other names. What about you? Is there like a name?
I don't like Chad. But I also don't like Todd.
Yeah. Oh, Paul. You know I have a thing about Pauls. I hate that name. Always have.
I like the name Paul. There's a guy.
Paul. Like,
sometimes I watch tarot readings online. And there's this guy. He is in my algorithm and he's so funny. I'll just have to send you like a clip. All you have to do is watch the first 20 seconds of this guy. Mm-hmm. And his name is Paul. And
don't send it to me. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. No, you'll know immediately like what he's all about in the first couple seconds. But I don't know. Paul. Why do you dislike Paul?
Because of the way it sounds, Paul. Like, your name is so delightful. Christina. Mac.
Mackenzie Roman.
Great name.
Great name.
Paul. Sorry to any Pauls in the audience.
Pauls who are also wohos.
Delete us from your app right now. Just
kidding. I like the name Paolo.
It's Paolo. Great.
I had a student one time and her name was Paola. She was mm-hmm. like Mexican. And then she had a baby and named it Paula.
Okay, because Paula is the downgrade. Paula.
Yeah,
Paola.
Paola is a beautiful name, but
yeah.
I was like, okay.
Why did you? Why?
What?
Why not name her Paola? That's a better name.
I don't know.
I won't say that I think that a person will be bad because I have never actually met an adult with these names, but people got to stop naming their kids like. And I know I'm like the 1 millionth person who said this, but any like Aiden, Braden, Caden, Jaden.
You did this a couple shows ago, man.
I did.
Braden, Caden, Jaden.
That's just how I feel. It's so strong. I heard a girl named Paisley at the museum once, and I was like, no, you can't.
Matt, that's you talked about that too the last time we were talking about names.
It's at the forefront of my mind. I can't stop thinking about it.
You talked about Braden Caden Jaden. I had a student who was the biggest thorn in my side at the end of the year. It was the kind of thing where it's like, hey, Ms. Hare, I was just wondering if I could turn in a bunch of work, you know, the week before finals. And then I, because he was getting a D, and he was like, I really want to get a B.
Then you should have done your work. What?
What?
I really want $1 million. Okay.
I had a sexual one, but yeah, like we all want things.
Yeah,
but that doesn't mean that you just are entitled to them. And he had one of those names. I won't say which one it was, but I was like, what is it with kids today? No, the funniest thing was I have a friend who is, she's either 29 or 30, and she was like, the generation below me is a lost generation. We have failed them. And I'm like, wow. Okay, old lady. So-and-so. Like, it's so crazy to hear somebody that young, like, disparaging the youth.
Well, I don't know any youth. Well, I know a few youths, but like, I'm not a teacher, but I see some TikToks where some, and I don't know how true this claim could be because this, I heard this shit all when I was a teenager and a child too. And I also don't think it's great to be cultivating an atmosphere for the younger generation of, we all hate you. You suck. Cause that's what happened to me was all the time I had random teachers just being like, and you kids today. And I was like, I didn't do anything. But I have seen a lot of TikToks of people saying, these kids, they're out of control. All of them. They're menaces to society.
Yeah.
Is it true? Do you think? Yeah. You seen any sort of like dip in behavior?
It's just different. I just feel like every generation learns a different set of skills. And this generation, the people that I'm teaching are by and large aged 16 to 21, let's say. It used to be a whole lot more variety than that, but that's kind of the way that it is today. And one thing that I did agree with that my friend said is most of them, or a lot of them, do have an earbud in all the time.
All the time?
In class, too. Like,
wow.
You know, talking to me, like, with an earbud in their ear. So I do feel like, you know, it's a highly distractible group of people. But
yeah,
I don't know. Well, as you know, we're in the South, and they're all real polite, by and large. I mean, they're all pretty meek, and even if they have strong opinions, like they couch them in such a way, you know, that's very polite and seemingly, you know, accepting of other viewpoints.
That's lovely.
I have one little guy who on like one of the last class periods was saying, you know, I really didn't want to talk about religion because I have my own beliefs, but, you know, I was glad that we were able to talk about it and people could disagree. And I'm like,
that's lovely.
That's what we're here for. And, you know, I had asked them, what kind of advice would you give to the next group of people taking this class? And almost all of them said, have an open mind.
Oh, that's so lovely.
I was like, yeah, that's like so cool. So this friend of mine who's, you know, 29 or 30, and I are going to plan a course together. I'm really excited. And it's a critical thinking course, and I haven't taught one of those in about 8 years. So I'm very excited. That's one of the projects I have for the next 3 weeks.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And she has recently taught it. And so that's cool. And yeah, I think it's going to be good, but I've just been thinking for the last 2 or 3 weeks, like, what do I want? Well, yeah. I want them to think critically.
Yeah.
And so I think in the beginning, I'm just going to try to come up with like a set of questions that they can just like rattle through and then give them different contexts for where they can apply this like method. And I think it's going to be the best thing I've ever done.
That's awesome. And I feel like that is very poignant. Like, I feel like misinformation is at an all-time high, and it's so easy to just take things at face value. So that the practice of critical thinking is like definitely important. I feel like it's important for everybody, but I feel like if I would say something about the youth, it's that I feel for them, because I feel like there's just a lot of misinformation and biased stuff around. So, yeah. And it's hard to suss it all out.
Yeah, and they spend a lot of time online, and as AI gets more and more sophisticated and deep fakes get, you know, better and better, then it's going to be more and more difficult for them. So, yeah. I think it's great. I wish it were, or I wish it were a required course.
Me too.
But it is very popular, so at least that's something. But yeah, I think they're distractible, but so am I.
Yeah, like who isn't? Like the person who isn't distractible right now is the outlier, and I would like to take lessons from them, because the way that I start to feel so much better and more productive and everything, like my phone died randomly because it's getting shitty now. And I was just left without a phone for a few hours because I put it up in the other room. And then I like did chores and I was like, I would not have done this if I had my phone. Like, I can't remember the last time my phone died. And yeah. I was kind of taken aback, like, wow, I need to get, like, I saw something that made so much sense. It was like, the internet is great when it's like a brief little reprieve from a busy day. But when it's your whole day, it's horrible and you're going to feel bad. But it can be so great when you're like, well, I've been so busy, let me check my phone real quick. And then you get back to what you're doing, you know? But that's not how I do it.
Yeah. No, I'm way too attached to my phone. And I mean, I remember that feeling, and it was when I went camping once. And I had no reception.
Yeah.
And we also, we couldn't get TV either. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, we were glamping. Okay. We were glamping. We were not camping. Okay. But, you know, we had to like go and get cables and stuff. And, you know, if we were going to watch any kind of like DVDs or anything.
Yeah.
Like it is good to be reminded, you know, to take breaks from the phone. I love it. I'm too attached to it. I also have to break up with one of the games or two games that I play on my phone. Like,
yeah.
And today I had a great day. I made a list. I stuck to my list. I did a lot of work. When I would take breaks, I would play a game. And mm-hmm. Not that that's a bad thing to do, but, you know, maybe do some other things too, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of games are predatory too. Like they're made to just, I feel like they're made to make you anxious and feel bad sometimes.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I just have the experience of the games that I play as an old lady, but yeah, I can for sure believe that.
Yeah.
Well, you know what else can make you feel bad?
What?
Is when you hire somebody to be in your movie and they just keep eating all your crew.
I mean, this guy, this Max Shrek.
I do want to make a public apology for on the last podcast that I released, which was Videodrome with our good friend Stefan. I called my dear son Max at one point. And now, in my defense, we were talking about Betamax, and there was a character in the movie named Max. Was there a person named Max? No, we were just talking about Betamax.
Excuses.
I was trying to edit it. Dude, you don't know how long I tried to edit that, like, I just had to leave it in. I couldn't like edit around it.
You just like, and my son, Max, or wait, no, that's wrong. Mac, I'm saying you would cut in a new voice anyway. Okay. I did it to myself. That's how easy it is.
Should we get into it, Mac?
Okay, yes. I want the record to show that I picked the topic of vampires specifically because I've been so into this game, Baldur's Gate 3, and the companion that I'm dating in this playthrough is a vampire. And I've never really been that into vampires, but I was like, hee, let's do vampires. So our first film is Shadow of the Vampire. Feds, don't take this down, but you can't watch this anywhere else but in an illegal YouTube upload. So get it while it's hot. Though it's been up there for a few years, I don't think anybody's looking to take it down. The brief plot summary from IMDb. The filming of Nosferatu is hampered by the fact that its star, Max Schreck, is taking the role of a vampire far more seriously than seems humanly possible. And this is based off of the idea that apparently existed, though I can believe this, rumors are crazy now, that the real star of the film Nosferatu was a vampire.
Right.
That was not true. Or was it? It was directed by E. Elias Marriage and written by Stephen Katz. It stars John Malkovich, Willem Dafoe, Hart, Carrie Elwes, John Aidan Gillett, Eddie Izzard, who I believe now goes by Susie Izzard.
He and she go by both.
Oh, that's awesome. Udo Kier, Catherine McCormick, and Ronan Vibert. I almost said Vibert. Cinematography by Lou Bogue and edited by Chris Wyatt. It was released the 15th of May in 2000 at Cannes and December 29th, 2000 in the US and February 2nd, 2001 in the UK with a sick runtime of 92 minutes. Sick. I really liked this movie. I really liked the themes of directors and actors at war and going too far, because that is so prevalent actually in so many movies that I enjoy, which is it sucks when you love a movie and then you learn behind the scenes that those reactions are genuine in like a bad way.
Well, like, I mean, I kind of went down a rabbit hole, as I do sometimes, and at the end of this, after all the typical stuff that we do, I put in a thing about method actors.
Ooh, that's awesome, because I had pulled up a list of like method actors who went too far.
Oh, awesome.
Because I love that topic.
Do you want to do that now or do you want to do that later?
We can do it later.
All right, cool.
All right. Well, like I said, this plot revolves around a fake telling of the shooting of the real movie Nosferatu. In 1921, German director F.W. Murnau is shooting Nosferatu, an unauthorized version of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Murnau is a lot. This guy is capital P pretentious. In the John Malkovich, I love his voice. Like, what is the way he says things and delivers lines? It's very similar throughout a lot of movies he does, but I don't mind it. I always love it. I'm a big fan. He wears like, you know, a white lab coat, fucking aviation glasses while filming a movie. And these are silent films also. Like, this isn't Michael Bay, you know, with explosions. The crew calls him Hair Doctor. And he, while beginning the shoot of this film, he's keeping his team in the dark about their schedule and who the actor playing the vampire Count Orlok is. It's left to the film's other main actor, Gustav von Wangenheim, to explain that the lead is an obscure German theater performer named Max Schreck, who is a character actor, which is like, when you then get to the reveal and like just describing him as a character actor, I don't know why it was so funny to me. Like if we're taking this at face value and this guy was like a method actor, and you'd be like, well, he's a character actor. What do you expect?
Okay. I had a really hard time with this movie, and I watched it like 4 times. That's not to say I sat and like watched it with my eyeballs and no distractions, seriously, you know, with my full attention 4 times, not at all. But it took me a while to get into this. And the last time I did sit and watch it, I really enjoyed it. I think it's really funny. And some of the lines just like flew past me like the first time. And there's a lot in the first scene. Like we're given a lot of information. And one of the funniest things to me is that Eddie Izzard, or Susie Izzard, depending on the day, says that Max Schreck is from the Russian school. And what he means by that is method acting. Mm. And so I was just like, oh, that's pretty funny.
Yeah.
That's the way they would sell. That's the way that the director would sell this to the actors and stuff.
Yeah. And he thinks that that's enough explanation. And we, the audience, don't even know how fucking crazy Willem Dafoe is about to be in this movie. I say that in a good way. And just imagine if this is your boss and he's like, guys, he's a character actor. I mean, duh.
From the Russian school. Yeah.
Yeah. He's to involve himself fully in his role, Schreck will only appear amongst the cast and crew in makeup. It will only be filmed at night, and he will never break character. I have a quote from Willem Dafoe about method acting, which I thought was great. Did you also have this?
No, I don't think so.
He's when Willem Dafoe was recently asked what he feels about method acting, because it kind of, you know, was talked about for a little bit, he said, I was never really trained in that. I don't even respond to that. I'm more like a dancer, I think, in terms of everything, doing things and reacting. Don't force it. If you don't force it, you'll find a purer reaction. Because as an actor, you're not meant to be selling a psychology. You're not telling a story by pushing buttons. You're having an experience. You need to approach that in good faith and in an open way. I love him. And that when he was studying for this role, he didn't look up anything about Max Schreck. He just watched Nosferatu and studied his movements. And I'm like, that makes so much sense, because this is not what Max Schreck, you know, like, this is not an autobiography. You know, it's not a biopic.
But it is. And I did not rewatch Nosferatu, but some of the most iconic movements and poses from Nosferatu, I mean, you can totally see them in Willem Dafoe's performance. And it's so delightful.
He must have had a blast. Like, you just get to do that the whole time on film.
I just may have some, when I have these, like, I just wanted to say that Eddie/Susie Izzard is such a delight as the actor. I love his makeup for one thing. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, he's taking it on faith that this guy is an actor, and he's not. Like, he doesn't know what he's doing. And so I just love how confounded it is. He's like, Max, man, like, just pretend. You don't need this prop to be exactly accurate.
Yeah.
And, I just love it so much. And after Susie is no longer in the film, I didn't enjoy it as much, because I think this is just so much fun.
Yeah. After filming scenes in a studio with leading actress Greta Schroeder, who's like a total diva, you know, and I guess she and Murnau also have had like a sexual relationship at some point, like based on the way he's grabbing on her.
I know, but the real Murnau, I think, I'm pretty sure, was gay, so.
Again. And like, that is, it does feel like that's how Murnau is played also. Like, and not even in like a stereotypical way. It's just, if you told me that John Malkovich plays a gay character in this movie, I'd be like, yeah. I mean, even the way he grabs her is so like, Well, I don't know.
Doesn't he go to like a drag club?
Yeah, and they even say like somebody makes a comment of like, oh, is he going with a woman? Maybe a man. And then it's just, you know.
Yeah. But yeah, the one that has maybe a weird direction, or I don't know, like in the scene, it does seem like they've had
yeah,
a
they're intimate.
Thing. Yeah.
It's weird. So Murnau takes his cast and crew to a remote inn in Czechoslovakia to film on location. And he's like, guys, Shrek is already there learning the craft. You know, we'll meet him there. When they get there, and this place is like, you know, it does look like they are filming on location of where a vampire would live in Czechoslovakia. They have to remove crucifixes around the inn to film, and the landlady gets super distressed while they're shooting a scene. And they have this amazing effect when it goes from like the film, if you think about it in a meta way, you know, the film we're watching to then it kind of bleeds into the black and white. It's so good. Like every time it happens, it's great to watch. And as they're shooting this, like landlady comes into scene and he's like all pissed off. And I loved it when they showed him like doing the direction for everybody, like, because they don't, you know, really have lines because it's a silent film. And so he's just reading out like, and you open the page and what do you see? You see this. And like, this is the way he delivers it is so entertaining. And I had to write down his quote when they're going to, like, they start on this train ride. And so he's kind of, I guess, setting the vibe for everyone as they go to Czechoslovakia. He says, our battle, our struggle is to create art. Our weapon is the moving picture. Because we have the moving picture, our paintings will grow and recede. Our poetry will be shadows that lengthen and conceal. Our light will play across living faces that laugh and agonize. And our music will linger and finally overwhelm because it will have a context as certain as the grave. We are scientists engaged in the creation of memory, but our memory will either, I don't know what that word I wrote is, blink or fade. I love that quote. I had to play it and listen to it again. I just feel like it sets up his character so well, but that is also very beautiful. That's somebody who truly believes in like film, you know?
Yeah.
So then we just get a few little scenes. Like they have this cameraman named Wolfgang Müller, who starts falling into this like strange hypnotic state, kind of like he's under a thrall. Gustav discovers a bottle of blood amongst the team's food supplies. And then we see someone delivering a caged ferret. And we just see like a blurry Shrek in the background with his long fingers, just kind of like twitching in delight. One night, Murnau rushes his team up to a nearby old Slovak castle for the first scene with the vampire. Shrek then appears for the first time. And like the other leading actor is like kind of amazed, you know, and wowed. And everyone is, you know, being like, that is such an amazing reaction. But I feel like the other actor is more like, no, that was like, I'm freaked out by this guy. The film's producer, Albin Grau, is confused when Murnau tells him that he originally found Shrek in the castle that they're in, because he's like, okay, this guy is not an actor. Where did you find him? He's like, right here. What? Soon after the completion of the scene, Wolfgang is found collapsed in the tunnel into which Shrek has receded. And I do feel like the movie, it kind of enters a dreamlike state after this point, because your suspension of disbelief, I feel like, just erodes. At least for me, like, I did enjoy this movie, but I was like, nobody, like, we're just going to send this guy to the hospital? Like, what do you think happened? Like,
yeah.
But it keeps going. Whilst filming a dinner scene between Gustav and Shrek, Gustav accidentally cuts his finger because Murnau, you know, is telling him to slice towards himself. And then he, like, yells and the guy accidentally cuts himself. And, so we get to see the first little, you know, peek more into the curtain of Murnau being a fucking weirdo. And Gustav is like pissed off. He's like, you did that on purpose. Shrek reacts wildly and tries drinking from Gustav's wound. Also, before this, there's such a great scene with Willem Dafoe, and he's just like, it's really funny. Like, he's not an actor, you know, and everybody's kind of confused because they're like, well, yeah, this guy looks like otherworldly, but like, he's looking right in the camera. He's like not taking direction. The lights fail, and when they return, Shrek is at Wolfgang's neck. Albin orders filming ended for the night, and the crew rushes from the castle, leaving Shrek behind. Alone, Shrek examines the camera equipment, fascinated by footage of a sunrise. I didn't realize that that was what was happening. I just thought he was so wowed by, but yeah, it's because it's a sunrise.
Right. Yeah. I just made a note of this, and I just said Dafoe is the goat because he is. It's a silent moment. And he's in this, you know, insane makeup, but you can still tell that this is amazing for him, and he just wants to see the sunrise.
Oh, that is really beautiful. With Wolfgang near death, Murnau is forced to bring in another cinematographer, Fritz Arno Wagner. After chastising Shrek in private for attacking his crew members and threatening him with harm if he does not control himself in Murnau's absence, a threat that Shrek challenges due to his immortality. And he says, like, how are you going to harm me? I am not sure myself how I would harm myself.
Yeah.
I love that
line. And yeah, I mean, Malkovich is at full Malkovich. In this scene. He's like, how dare you eat my crew? You know, and just like giving it to him. And Orlok is just like,
okay.
Yeah, I'm going to do that.
Like, what do you think?
And then he's like, why the cinematographer? Why didn't you just eat the script girl? He goes, I think I will eat her later.
Like, who says I'm not? And they're also, we find out that Murnau is like promising Greta to him, like, because he gets super intense where in the scene of the film, he sees Gustav's locket with a picture of Greta. And that's a very real reaction from him. And then we find out that Murnau is like, be in my movie. I'll give you this beautiful, you know, woman. Like, holy shit.
Yeah,
and then
pretty
the obvious of
if you think of
what were you gonna say?
I was just gonna say, if you think of the implications,
like, yeah,
in the real world, it's absolutely
this
horrifying.
Man's disgusting, and the scene with her later is like very disturbing to
that
me.
That was the scariest part for me.
Same, yeah. It was horrible, but I got in a good way though. I feel like it was done. It's supposed to be horrible, and. Yeah, just, you know, this guy, he does not care that Wolfgang is the one. He cares it's the cinematographer. Don't, you know, affect my working pieces. And I love this quote from Murnau about Shrek, to like when he's trying to placate the crew. And he's like, Shrek's peculiarities are like lovemaking games. You believe them when they happen, but they always stop short of anybody being seriously hurt. What?
Yeah.
And I wrote down, he's telling on himself, because like, just shows how fucked up this guy is, I feel like. Yeah. Like how, and then you learn just how not normal this, it gets worse, you know, the more you find out. Then Orlok says, I don't think we no longer need the writer. I don't think we need the ship. I will not sail. And Murnau is like, it's on the boat. What are we going to do without you? It's just great. Like, Orlok's a diva. He's like, rewrite the script. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah. And then we get an interstitial card, and it says that Murnau built a ship on land so that Orlok would, you know, perform on the ship.
Yeah.
But before that, he said, well, we have to go to this island. It's like over water. Like, you have to get on the ship to get to the island. And he goes, you can get there by air.
he's the best.
He's really fun.
Um, While Murnau returns to Berlin to calm financiers of the film, Schreck approaches Albin and the screenwriter, Henrik Galeen, while they're kind of like around a fire, just drinking. They believe he's just still in character. And I love this scene. He grabs some of like the vodka they're drinking and says that he sees like Dracula as extremely lonely, and that the scene where he's trying to remember how to do otherwise mundane chores that he has not needed to perform for centuries is deeply sad and upsetting to him. And they're like, you know, pretty jovial, like, oh, and hey, Max, what do you think about this? You know, like trying to see what this weirdo will say. But they are also like affected by his response because it is so like earnest, you know?
Yeah.
He says the saddest scene in Dracula is when Count Dracula, without servants, has to serve his guest. And the way he describes it of like, you know, picking the things up and, you know, he's not going to eat any of this food and he's not going to do anything himself. It's all a show. When they ask how he became a vampire, Schreck says that it was a woman. Schreck then snatches a bat out of the air and viciously sucks its blood. Grau and Galeen, thanks to their drunkenness on schnapps, are just like really impressed. They're just like, this guy, man, where'd they find this guy? Well, later that night, Schreck attacks and kills a crew member on the film set and throws him from the ship. It's really funny.
It's just so.
It feels like it's out of nowhere. Just, ah!
But that's what vampires do. They attack and kill people.
Yeah, you know, can't have this guy on your set. Production then moves to the island of Heligoland to film the final scenes. And Murnau, in a laudanum-induced stupor, because he just gets super... Oh, okay, I also wrote down... Like Greta, at one point, she starts, you know, wigging out in her bed, and they're like, oh, she's on morphine. I got to point out, listen, I never took morphine recreationally. So, yeah, I was in a lot of pain. But I feel like the last thing you'd be doing is like, you know, like wiggling around, giggling. Like, she's like going ham.
Yeah.
I was like, this is the weirdest depiction of being on morphine I've ever seen.
Yeah, same. Like, I've only ever been on morphine when I've been in pain. So maybe it's different if you're not in any pain. But, I mean, even the twins at the end of Dead Ringers, they're not giggling.
Yeah. You want to chill. Like, you just feel good. So
I agree. There could have been a different drug that would, you know, cause a giggling fit, I think.
Yeah. But Murnau is on laudanum. And he then admits to Albin and Fritz that Schreck is an actual vampire. And in return for his cooperation, he has promised him Greta. And they're both like, what? The two realize that they are trapped on the island, leaving no choice but to complete the film that night. Because I guess they're still going to go ahead with it. If this was real, I obviously see Murnau continuing, but I'm like, why are these guys doing this? Like, what? Why aren't they trying anything to get away and help Greta? It just feels like they're not as crazy as Murnau, and yet they follow the same, like, they'll do whatever he says.
Kind of. I agree.
Seemed weird to me. So they kind of filmed the final scene, and everything is just so picture perfect in this. This is what my mom and I were talking about of being the most uncomfortable, because we have Greta, and now knowing that he plans on just feeding Greta to Orlok, but she doesn't know anything's happening. And, you know, she meets Schreck for the first time, and it's just kind of like, okay. But Shrek's very like at one point she's like getting into the bed and he's just like right behind her. She doesn't even notice him, but he looks so scary. Like, he's not hiding anything. Like, if I was her, I'd be like, get me the fuck out of here. And she does say that, because when he bends down in the scene because the direction is he's going to try to drink her blood. She's going to get him with the stake, and then he's going to die. but she becomes hysterical because in the vanity, she notices that Shrek does not cast a reflection in real life and just starts screaming. And it's really scary. Like, you actually feel the, like, I don't know how vulnerable she is. And this is so horrible. They like hold her down and then inject her with morphine. And this is the actual, or is it laudanum?
Who knows? Laudanum, I don't know. I think.
Laudanum. Right. Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
It should be morphine, I feel like, for this. But she then, you know, just kind of gets placated and passes out. But it's really disturbing.
Yeah.
Especially because these other two men know what is going to happen and are just going along with it. Like, she's disposable. And then they just sit there and film as Shrek feeds on her and just is biting into her and whatnot. But the laudanum in her blood is putting him to sleep. And we then see him snoring with his eyes open.
That's a kind of a cool shot. And then there's a shot of the men, like, kind of just looking at him, just smoking and just like taking in this whole scene.
It's with so this weird.
Dead woman.
And them. That, like, you don't even care. And Murnau is just, or they're all just filming the whole time. At dawn, the three then attempt to open a door and let in the sunlight to destroy Shrek, but he had already cut the chain to the mechanism, trapping them in the process. Fritz and Albin then attack Shrek, but he kills them easily. And then Murnau, this whole time, he takes over filming, and it's kind of one of those where he's got to like crank it the whole time, and he's just doing it in a stupor, like, and kind of directing them like it's normal. And completely ignores the deaths of his colleagues and the malicious glare that Shrek, like, he's just right in front of him. And I wish I had written it down, but he says something like, just like, actor, can you please get in line, or like something like that. And Shrek is almost just like, what? Like, he's confused. he says, can you please return to your mark and get another take? And so Shrek goes back and starts to feed on Greta, and Murnau films it. I love this scene. It's just so weird. So Galeen and the crew arrive, and they manage to lift the door, and it destroys Shrek with the sunlight. And I've not seen Nosferatu, but I know some of these poses are like shot for shot, like, you know, him kind of flinching from the sunlight. It's so perfect. And having become completely obsessed with the film, Murnau asks for an end slate to his rattled crew. And they apply again. I'm like, why are you doing this? And then he stops the camera and calmly states, I think we have it. Woof. That ending scene is so intense for how kind of like light the whole movie has felt, but they don't make that part fun, you know?
No.
But I feel like it's to a good effect of like, no, this is fucked up. And again, why I think like, I love this concept. We should do more movies like this. Almost kind of like, I hate Quentin Tarantino. He sucks. But I liked the concept of like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, of this idea of like, what if real event, but that didn't happen, and this other cooler thing happened instead.
I got you. His revisionist take on it. I got you.
Yeah. I love that. More people should do that with more recent things. And because you see a lot with, like, you know, Abraham Lincoln fighting, you know, vampires, whatever, Pride and Prejudice and zombies. No, I show me something like within modern human history, but horror. I like that. But don't try to like slander anybody, obviously.
Right.
Be upfront that this is not what happened, but what if it did?
What a great idea.
Here's some trivia for you. This was based in part upon a legend that Max Schreck was in reality a vampire, which is why he played the role of Orlok / Dracula so well. Some variations of the legend suggest that Nosferatu from 1922 was the only film Shrek made, though in reality he was already a stage and screen veteran by the time Nosferatu was shot, and would appear in many non-vampiric roles before his death in 1936. Rips. Murnau's line, if it isn't in the frame, it doesn't exist.
Oh my god, what a perfect reading.
So good.
Oh, you were just like channeling.
I feel like I can hear him in my head.
Moment. Oh my god.
That's what I mean, is like he has such a way of speaking that's so like distinct, but I love it. But I love this line. It's so like, oof. This might not seem related, but I've just been kind of learning a lot about family vloggers, and it's very disturbing, and I think a form of child abuse. And I really feel like it's scary how much this bleeds into a lot of people's real life of like only doing anything for display. You know,
it's just like the way we do the podcast, though, Mac, right? I mean, we don't talk out.
Cut.
I mean, the only conversations we actually have are.
I don't know who this woman is. Oh, yeah. So Murnau's line is a paraphrase of a piece of advice the real Murnau gave to the young Alfred Hitchcock when the latter visited the UFA studios in Berlin before becoming famous. Hitchcock never forgot this advice and was still quoting it when making his final movie in the mid-1970s. Talk about directors that went too far. The use of the quotation in the context of Shadow of the Vampire is a distortion of what the real Murnau meant. I'm sure.
Yeah.
The locomotive that conveys the film crew to Czechoslovakia is named Charon. In Greek myth, Charon is the fairy, was the ferryman who conveyed the souls of the dead across the river Styx. I have 150 hours in the game Hades, and there's a character named Charon in there. So I totally knew that. Thank you, Hades. Udo Kier, who appears as Albin Grau, played the Count himself in Blood for Dracula from 1974 and Vampire Elder Dragonetti in Blade from 1998.
Oh, I didn't know the second part. Oh. I almost watched Blood for Dracula the other night. It's on It's on something. It's on Tubi or something. Mm-hmm. You can watch it in the States.
Watch it for this guy. Willem Dafoe's portrayal of Max Schreck was nominated for an Academy Award. This is the only time anyone has been nominated for their portrayal of a vampire. What? That's kind of amazing.
It is pretty amazing when you think about it.
That's interesting. Has Dafoe ever won an award? An Academy Award?
Well, look it up on your clackety clack machine.
List of awards and nominations received. Just show me awards. Just show me the wins, baby. Okay, there's 84, so I'm not reading all that. He's won something. But he lost this year to Benicio del Toro in Traffic. And the film also lost Best Makeup to Jim Carrey's The Grinch. I love calling it Jim Carrey's as if it's his movie.
It kind of is.
It is.
I mean, that makeup, though.
Amazing.
Amazing makeup.
Amazing. It was full body, you know? Like, and guys, I watched the behind the scenes of that movie a lot as a kid. And let me tell you, he was in that chair a long time. I heard that story many times. Just prior to the crew's arrival at the castle for the first night of filming, a quick establishing shot depicts Count Orlok, disguised as a carriage driver, arriving at his castle with Hutter. This was a scene edited from the original Nosferatu, featuring Max Schreck and Gustav von Wangenheim. Willem Dafoe groped Catherine McCormick's right breast for roughly 5 minutes in a single scene. Yeah, it's just such a sustained shot of him doing that, and then like watching him. It's so weird. God. This was the second time Willem Dafoe worked in a vampire movie. The first was The Hunger from 1983, and the third was Daybreakers from 2009.
I don't think I've seen Daybreakers, have you?
I don't think so. I gotta watch it. I just gotta watch his whole discography. What is it? His whole list on IMDb. Here's some famous method actors. Daniel Day-Lewis. He reportedly caught pneumonia filming Gangs of New York as he refused to wear an insulated coat and locked himself in a solitary confinement during the night during the filming of In the Name of the Father. Okay, I feel like method acting like this is understandable. if you're like, I want to know that feeling, it's the method acting when you make it everyone's problem. That's the issue, you know? But at least this is like solitary confinement. Maybe that really put him in that headspace, you know? I feel like that makes sense. Hilary Swank, for her controversial portrayal of transgender man Brandon Tina in Boys Don't Cry, Hilary Swank, quote, walked around trying to pass as a boy for 5 weeks before filming. I don't know why that's so funny to me. It's giving Tyra Banks putting on a fat suit and trying to be like, I know how you live now. Seeing what worked and what didn't work and losing a bunch of body fat so that my face would be thinner. My neighbors thought I was my cousin Billy from Iowa. This is like kind of surreal to read. The idea of like a cis woman being like, I'm going to try something fun. Here's a fun little experiment I have. Of filming Black Swan, Natalie Portman has said, I thought I literally was going to die. Per NPR, Portman endured several injuries, including a dislocated rib, calloused feet, and her toenails falling off. Well, that's what it's like to be a ballerina. And she continued to film and dance through the pain. But it wasn't the end of the world. She recalled, real dancers dance with such incredible injuries that you wouldn't even believe. Those people put their bodies through the ringer.
Yeah.
Famous critics of the practice, Will Poulter and Mads Mikkelsen. Actor Will Poulter has famously criticized the technique, saying, if your process creates an inhospitable environment, then to me, you've lost sight of what's important. Method acting shouldn't be used as an exercise for inappropriate behavior, and it definitely has. I have never been on like the receiving end, obviously, but like I agree. I feel like the same should be said of anybody doing any sort of like art form of like, if you're putting yourself and other people in danger, even like emotional duress, it's not worth it. And I don't want to see it. You know, I don't like pranks that aren't consensual. You know, I don't like where the person hasn't agreed to be pranked or surprised in some way. I don't like any of that. I don't care if it's an authentic reaction. That's just messed up. Like, to whose gain? Mads Mikkelsen is also not a fan. He called the practice bullshit. And just number one in this list of 12 actors who took method acting too far from ScreenRant.com, Jared Leto in Suicide Squad. I feel like this does need a special shout out. They write, few actors who took method acting way too far are as controversial as Jared Leto. As part of playing the Joker in Suicide Squad, Leto admitted to sending items like anal beads, used condoms, and both live and dead animals to his co-stars, many of whom confirmed receiving them. Leto later denied sending condoms or any gifts that crossed the line to his fellow Suicide Squad cast members, saying that his gifts were given and received with laughter, fun, and adventure. It's all film. To be fair, it was Suicide Squad's script that ruined Leto's Joker, even though controversy still surrounds his performance. Can I hear one of them say that it was cool? Like, like, also, like, excuse, I feel like the Joker wouldn't do that. He's got a little bit more class. I don't think he'd send condoms to people. That's just me.
Used condoms.
No. Yeah, used, that's even worse. It was 1 million times worse. Well, okay. What does Letterboxd have to say about Shadow of the Vampire? Disaster gave it 1 star. Shrek could definitely make a career as one of those nail clacking ASMR girlies. Okay, there is a great scene where he's doing the, and I feel like it almost captured some of like what must have been Willem Dafoe's like just having fun with it. I would have fun too. He does have some gnarly long nails. Belly B. Kelly 9 gave it 1 star. I am not exactly sure what it was about this movie, but I didn't like it. Like, really at all. I am down for some weird every once in a while, but this one was a little too slow moving and a little too weird for me. Vincent Gregory Yu gave it 1 star. Great premise, but Willem Dafoe notwithstanding, this was an absolute chore to go through. A joke that never even gets to take off. A movie that fails to figure itself out. In hindsight, it peaked at John Malkovich whispering, good pussy, good pussy, which is in the first 5 seconds of the movie. That one, I did not like that line. But that was a very cute cat on screen. What was I going to say about... that this movie, I found out that Nick Cage, who is the executive producer, really wanted at first to play Shrek, and then he wanted to play both Shrek and Murnau. But Katz was like, I have my eye on Willem Dafoe. And so then Nick Cage was like, cool, I love this movie. You should hire John Malkovich. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, wow.
X gave it 5 stars. As close to a perfect film as I am able to imagine. Breathtaking and brilliant, I am so in love that even things others might see as flaws seem purposeful, intentionally crafted to evoke some deeper connection with the mythology of our own past. Just fucking wow. Cannibal Mukbang gave it 5 stars. This is one of my comfort movies for some ungodly reason. I love it more every time I watch it, honestly. It serves as both an earnest ode to the art of cinema and a critique of the auteur myth. Shadow is a film that asks, how much suffering is worth it for the sake of our art? I would 100%. Like, that's, they wrote all my thoughts down. Desireem 17 gave it 5 stars. Midnight Mass, but instead of a priest, it's a film guy.
Yeah.
Well, what phobia is that? Aosophobia is fear of the dawn. Let's rate it in fake nails.
Oh, good one.
I'd give it 3 in a broken nail, so 3.5 nails.
Yeah.
It's like...
You liked it more than I did.
I liked it, but when I... Like, perfectly crafted movie, I don't agree. I do think it's a little bit slow. I did enjoy it, and I feel like it's beautiful, and the performances and the shoots are awesome, but it just was a little... I feel like if it was half the time, honestly, it would be better.
It takes a lot. I don't know. Maybe you just have to be in the right frame of mind to watch it, and I wasn't.
Three times. Oh yeah, one time. We got it good on one. 4 times the charm.
I feel like that first scene is just like so slam full of information.
Yeah.
And I also feel, now this is interesting. I've seen Nosferatu and you haven't, but you enjoyed it more than I did. So that's very interesting to me.
It was like, well, I'm just a Willem Dafoe stan. Yeah. And I guess a John Malkovich stan too. It had enough of them that it got me through any boredom.
Yeah, I'm with you.
What have we learned? Well, don't trust a vampire.
Yeah, and if you're the only woman on a film set,
run. Get out.
Make a bunch of friends with the crew, but God, now it's, I mean, I hope it's better now that everybody has cameras, you know, but
yeah, it can't be as bad.
It's so disgusting.
Yeah.
Like the word you used before, disposable, like just that women are so disposable and that their abuse and death is just like, not a big deal.
Yeah, it's something you can use as a bargaining chip.
Gross.
And somehow Murnau, I do think, seems by the end. Like, somebody in the YouTube comments of this illegal upload was like, who is the bigger monster, Murnau or Orlok? I was like, Murnau, what are you talking about? Like, Orlok's just doing his, like, pigs is pigs. Like, he's gonna kill people. Like, what do you, he's a beast, but Murnau is, like, even by the end, when you see the look Shrek gives him in the camera, he's like, what the fuck's wrong with you? Would we watch it again? I think I would, but it would be my second watch, so I don't know if you want to do a fifth one.
I feel like you're making fun of me a little bit.
No, I'm surprised.
No.
Yeah.
Probably not. I don't see why I would. I mean, honestly. Yeah. But just sidebar. I told you that the internet said I'm autistic, right? Like that online.
Oh yeah,
quiz.
The test. Yeah.
Yes. So.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know.
It's not a surprise to me.
And also says what it said was like you display more like autistic qualities than like most people, something like that. And then it also said I'm for sure OCD, which we already kind of knew because of the intrusive thought syndrome. But some of the questions you can kind of tell sometimes. Like one of the questions was, there are good and bad numbers, true or false?
Yeah.
There are.
There are.
So, but if I answer yes.
But the thing is not and everyone would answer yes is the point.
There are good and bad numbers. I don't know.
I just think it's really funny. I feel like both of us have a lot of things going on in our brain. We are not like a room with the two of us. Just because we agree it's true does not mean it's a universal experience. Like this means nothing.
Okay, it's a fair point. I mean, oh God. Oh, I needed that laugh.
But it makes me also feel so close to you. Like, aw, we do both. Or like, I get you.
Yeah. Back to what's really important.
Do you have a favorite scene and or kill?
I'm kind of divided between when Wangenheim is like, come on, Max, like, just pretend, you know, and Orlok is just like not understanding what this piece of paper is he's supposed to be holding, and he just doesn't get what's going on. And I guess, yes, that would be my favorite one. I mean, I think the final scene also is quite great.
But like that one, it's so funny seeing this like fish out of water and like everybody. And if you just put yourselves, if they were like, oh my God, this guy just needs to get a grip, you know, like, but he's there's no contract here.
And I'm trying to think of like what Eddie/Susie had been in at that point in terms of acting. And I don't know. I had mostly seen stand up. I there was a show, The Riches.
I've never seen it.
I don't know if it was at this time, but I never watched it. So I didn't really know about like their acting or whatever. But yeah. I just thought they were amazing. And I don't know. Like I looked up what pronouns to use, and their pronouns are he, she. So I guess it doesn't matter. They said sometimes I feel like Eddie and sometimes I feel like Susie. So
I love that. Mm. It's so cool to see somebody like, because I feel like that's a very like, being trans, like there's always going to be people who don't get it, but like that's a lot more like in a way visible, and I feel like could come under a lot of scrutiny or like disparaging, but to be so open about it and like confident is very cool.
Yeah.
Who wins the You Fool Award? I mean, Greta.
Greta for sure.
She was getting offers in New York for the stage, and you threw it, and that he just talked her into it. He's like, the film is the future. Shut up. Death is your future.
She said, the audience gives me life.
Yeah. You know? And that thing sucks it away.
Yes. So
And it, honestly, even, God, I'm just thinking that is so interesting because I know that there have to be a lot of actors who very much enjoy being a TV or a movie actor. But if you just think about, like, that makes so much sense, though. If at the time you could still make money being, I mean, I know people, some people make money on the stage, but not a lot do, not as much as being in movies. But like, that is such a more interactive experience, you know? Mm-hmm. It must feel more like, I don't know, than doing it, I guess, for, you know, some director guy.
Yeah. So that's Shadow of a Vampire. Shadow of the Vampire. Not just any vampire.
Shadow of Vampire.
Okay, let's get into rigor mortis.
Okay.
This was a Max suggestion.
Yes.
And I loved it.
Yay! Good.
Rigor mortis, the summary from IMDb states, a public housing tenement is plunged into a dark storm of supernatural chaos.
Understatement of the century.
Directed by Juno Mock, written by Philip Young, Jill Leung and Juno Mock, starring Chin Soo Ho, Anthony Chan, Cara Hui, Lo Hoi Pang, and Pa Hee Ching, edited by David Richardson. It was released on the 4th of September 2013 at Venice Days Festival and the 24th of October 2013 in Hong Kong. It has a running time of 101 minutes. Slightly long.
Yeah, but it's so action-packed that you can't even be mad at it, you know?
So we start with our hero, Chin Soo Ho, who is a depressed... Well, that's the actor. I don't know what the character's name is. Does he have a name? Anyway, we start with our main guy. He's a he's a depressed actor who has rented an apartment in a somewhat creepy-looking tenement building. And the first thing he does after getting rid of the nosy building guard, I didn't think he was that nosy.
He was so, well, I think he was a little, like, he was following him in there. But he was just sweet, you know? Yeah. He was just, like, trying to, because it was obvious this apartment is like a community, you know? And he's telling him, like, oh, incense, I'll bring you some incense in here. And but I guess if you were kind of getting it, if you're about to do what he's about to do, you'd probably be like, get the fuck out of here. But yeah, so sweet.
I do kind of like the scene. Like the guard, he's burning incense and he's
eating an orange. And he like puts the orange in his hand when he gets the keys.
Oh, it's very sweet. I don't know. I liked it. And then, you know, something bad's about to go down because the actor, I don't know where he got all these white sheets, but he's like, you know, carpeted the whole room in white sheets, which somebody pointed out is kind of like a white sheet that you put over the body of a dead person. So
yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
And it's covering everything like that too.
Everything. So, okay. So he hangs himself from the ceiling fan, but he's not successful. But also a spirit jumps into his body, making his attempt unsuccessful.
And then, spirit, it looks so cool. It's got this like squiggly stuff coming off of the back. Like, it's cool.
Very cool. And it's kind of like a skull kind of like creates the shape inside the sheet and everything.
Yeah.
And it like jumps into his body.
That scene was so cool.
It's pretty great. So he's saved by Yao, who not only cuts him down, but is able to dispel the ghosts, at least temporarily. And Yao is great.
I love this guy.
Gorgeous little glasses on his face.
He's got like a robe and slippers on. He's just like a quintessential like dude who's chilling. I don't know. He's picture perfect.
And so it turns out that Yao is a vampire hunter turned chef. And it also turns out I did not know this, that vampires are afraid of glutinous rice.
Yeah, I was like, whoa, new vampire lore just dropped.
And when he stopped having vampires to fight, he decided to cook the rice he always had on hand. Suho meets more of his neighbors, including Anti-Mui.
This lady. This actress has the sweetest face. Like, there's so many scenes where she made me cry. Like, and she's just, I feel like this movie creates the feeling of this apartment building so well. These people feel real. Like, mm-hmm. she's everyone's personal, like, tailor in the apartment building. She'll fix their clothes and she just loves her husband. Like, she just is a sweet woman, and she's so, like, kind of like unassuming, and just, I just loved her.
Me too. And I thought the actor who played Mui was just, like,
amazing.
So she experiences a horrible loss when her beloved husband Richard Ang dies. Okay, that's a lot. So we meet her. She introduces herself when he's downstairs, and she just fills in a lot of the, you know, the explanation. I mean, Lau makes two versions of the dinner, one for her and one for her husband, because she has diabetes. And yes, everybody gives her tailoring to do. And he's like, are you good at it? And then we learn later, no, she's not that good at it. But she does it. But there's also an interaction where another woman comes up to her and gives her a house coat and is like, your husband's not going to like it, but could you fix this for me? And you're kind of like, what does that mean? Well, yeah. Then cut to her husband's wearing the dress and she's like altering it with him.
And with it's it so on sweet. His body. He's like ranting, you know, about them, and she, like, just kind of sticks him with the needle at one point, you know, but it's all very sweet. Like, she's just, like, so happy to listen to him talk.
Yeah, and he's got a lot of thoughts. He thinks that there's a conspiracy, and that he doesn't like the lady whose dress it is. She's too fat, and she's eating up all the food, the wife Mui is like, your mouth, like. But it's very sweet, and so this scene where she's altering the dress is going to be echoed later in the
saddest way possible.
Oh lord. So I don't know if it's right after the alteration scene, but he leaves the apartment and he sees a little child in a landing below. And he falls and cracks his neck and is left for dead. He actually isn't dead at that moment, but we don't know that yet. So she has fallen asleep at her sewing machine, and she has a dream that she's washing her husband's feet, but they're very cold. And then she wakes up like, uh-oh. And so she visits the building necromancer.
We all have them.
Good. Hey, should have one.
Hey, a fellow apartment dwellers, you know what we're talking about.
And he does a bunch of what he can to bring her husband back.
And I mean, this guy is jacked up. Like, his face, like his face is just like the husband. Like, his teeth, you know, are, I don't know how to, his face is wrong now. It's been smushed, and the special effects are so grody, and the whole spells and whatnot are so, like, there's so much cracking of fingernails to bleed. I'm like, there has to be a better way to generate blood from your body than this. So many times people just break their fingernails, and I'm like, okay, I think you could have done this a better way.
But this is, if you look up the poster for this movie, his face is the poster, and he's got this mask on his face made up of all these coins. But his eyes are sewn shut.
Yeah, because she sews him back together.
together.
And she had to, like, put him in this, like, dirt bath, kind of. And
yeah, she buried him in the bathtub and has this, like, I love the piece of paper that mm-hmm. has, like, the prayer written on it that's, like, laying across his face. And now the necromancer keeps telling her, don't remove the mask. But I don't think she does she?
It's like, I guess she has to have, but it doesn't make sense why she would. Because no. It doesn't make sense because it's also like, she gets frustrated because it's taking too long. But why would removing that, like, if this guy tells you don't do this or else he won't come back, you would never take, like, it would be of utmost importance that you never take it off if you're this lady.
But it's so annoying, like, from an audience standpoint, because you know that when somebody repeats something three or four times, it's going to be relevant later, and it never is. But yeah. The one thing he does say is, if this doesn't work, there is other stuff we can do.
But it's fucked up, so don't. Let's just hope it doesn't get to that point. And so then she, after that, is that when we have this scene of her, like, when he's like standing there and she's just kind of going around him in a circle, like talking to him.
Yeah, it's so sad.
And she just breaks down crying.
Oh, it's just like, it's like glitching. it's an echo of the conversation that they had before. And she's like, it's like you're always saying, it's a conspiracy, you know, and she's like repeating these phrases and these things that her husband has said before. And, but it's so sad. And it's, you know, the lighting's very dark and obviously he's not responding at all because he's dead. So we have a situation where we have supernatural things at play. We have ghosts. One of the things that's going on in this building is we have ghosts who are twins. And so they will come into play, but I don't think that happens exactly yet. But I know that four is not like everybody's favorite number, you know, in Asian countries, but in many Asian countries, Japan and Korea, right?
Yeah, four, because I looked it up once. I was curious. It's because four, you can say yon or she, but then she is like die. Like you would say shine if you were saying like die. So.
Okay. Well, I don't know what it's like in China, but it's obvious, you know, the number for his apartment is 2442. Mm. So I'm sure that has some significance.
Sorry, this is going back, but. The character's name is the actor's name, which is why it's important, because he's the former star
of
Mr. Vampire.
Oh my gosh. Well, see, I don't know Mr. Vampire. Apparently this was a very popular series and it was comedic. And this is not a comedy at all. This is a pretty dark story. Oh, well, that makes so much sense. But we get some pretty, you know, imagery of, well, we get some information. Sorry, I'm kind of all over the place. We get some information about Chen's family. It looks like in a vision, that flashback that we have, like they met a violent end, because there's a picture of him. They're all sitting at the table and there's blood. That like starts to drip from their hands. We also see them leaving him, like walking away from him, and he has a phone that he's had for many years. It looks like at this point, an old kind of beaten up phone, and there's a voicemail that he won't delete because it's his son. And we flash back to when the son was drawing in marker on his dad's face, and the dad was drawing on the kid and everything. And the guy, our guy, Chin Su-ho, has the watch in marker still on his wrist.
Yeah. There was a scene where they just show him in a t-shirt, and I hadn't realized the whole marker thing, and I was like, does this guy have like the ugliest tattoo of all time?
So then Chin meets Yang Feng, who is a single mother, and she has a son named Pak. And they
ugliest wig I've ever seen.
I know.
They couldn't get a better wig. Come on. This is the worst wig.
It kind of took me out. Yeah. Wigs must be so expensive.
And yet, it's like somebody took regular scissors and just cut on this white wig. And I don't know. I just feel like, why make this? Because they never bring up the fact that this kid's, I guess, albino. But like, it's never, it's just like, look at this weird kid and his stupid wig hair. Just make him look normal. Like, yeah. I'm sorry. I don't mean like normal as in not albino, but like he doesn't even look like an actual albino, like somebody with albinism, you know? Like it's just kind of silly.
There's one part where Chin is talking to him, and the kid, I thought the kid was blind at first because he sort of like got his eyes closed like behind his bangs, and I'm like, what's going on? Because he isn't.
Yeah.
I think there's a really creepy vibe going on with all of these characters, but I feel like it's creepy enough. You don't have to add like,
yeah,
non sequiturs.
You could, and if you're going to do this, I feel like hire an actor who has albinism, but this just feels kind of like a costume. And yes, the only purpose is to be like, look at this creepy kid. And it's like, kids can be cool. Creepy without that. That's for fine. Sure. Without an ugly wig.
100%. So we learn the backstory of these people. So she used to be married to a guy who tutored two twin girls. But the tutor was a perv, and he raped one of the twins and was killed by the other twin. But the twin who killed the tutor inadvertently killed herself at the same time. And so the victim of the assault hanged herself. And then mom and son walked in and saw that scene.
That was not, like, I had to look it up because that whole, like, what exactly went down was not 100% clear to me. Mm-hmm. I was so confused as to, like, who was who. Because also everybody's wearing the exact same clothes. Mm-hmm. And, like, I just was so, like, wait, why are there two of these girls?
Yeah.
So it could have been made a little bit clearer.
Yeah, I got you. So now every time, so that's the apartment where Chin is living. So every time Yang Feng like looks in the apartment, all she sees is one of the twins hanging from the ceiling fan and the blood all over the apartment. So she's like traumatized every time she sees the open door.
But good for her, because the security guard says that she tries to go there every day. And I feel like that's actually kind of amazing that this character is trying to face her fears every single day.
Yes. Okay. I didn't get this at all. So the summary here says Chin resolves to banish the ghosts so that Yang and Pak can move in with him. I didn't get that at all.
There was like a scene where they were all hanging out.
They're all hanging out. They're eating. And I think Pak has been breaking in and peeing in the sink.
They pee together at one point, which is...
They do pee together at one point. But before that, Pak just like enjoys peeing in the sink.
One of life's greatest joys.
Oh, yeah. So Chin is sort of like used as bait to draw out the ghosts of the twin girls. And this was also like super confusing. So it's hard to see like what the point of all this is until it's all over with. But the whole point was to get the two twins together so that the spirit of the dead man could, I don't know. They had to have a body that was big enough.
House two spirits?
Why do they have to tie them together?
I don't know. I feel like they just wanted creepy twins. Like, they just wanted the one shot of the twins looking creepy later. But it makes more sense for it to just be one girl, I feel like.
Yeah. But I think there are probably, like, twin ghosts. Like, that's, like, all of these are totemic examples of ghosts in Chinese mythology.
Yeah. But, like, in the story, they didn't do enough. Yeah.
Yeah, it don't make no sense. So, anyway, there's a whole fight scene, and they bind the twins together, and they put them in this cabinet, and then they tie up the cabinet with this, like, string. Yao tells Gao to burn the cabinet, and Gao says he will.
And then he winks at the camera devilishly. Yeah. Basically, oh, okay, sure, I will.
So Mui says that she wants her husband to come back. Things are taking too long. And so she wants Gao's help. And Gao says, and she's like, should I, like, kill a black dog? Like, I'm giving him crow's blood every day. Like, what do I need to do? And he's like, none of that's going to help. You need the blood of a virgin. There's only one virgin in this damn apartment, right?
Yeah.
So, anyway. So, Uncle Yin, this is the security guard from the beginning. He is a little skeptical, and he's wondering what's going on. Where is Tung? And he... keeps asking questions. He won't shut up about it. So Mui does what she has to do. She kills him. She beats him to death.
So sad.
With a pot. Yeah. It's pretty
because he's doing the right thing. Like he's like asking like where is he? And then he sees that Mui's in the same apartment as the necromancer. So he's like, okay, buddy, like tell me what the deal is. And he's really trying to be helpful. And this is what she needs, but the grief, you know, was just brought her to this point. And I feel like it's so tragic because she is genuinely such, like, she's not just some, like, sweet lady. It's like, this lady feels like a kind soul, you know, and to see her so twisted is, like, one of the saddest parts of the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, but after this, I mean.
It's all over.
It's all over. So a little later, Pak comes to visit Mui alone.
Also, okay, this scene, the vampire hunter, like, he also notices something's weird. But he fucking sends Pak to go hang out with her. And I'm like, this is all your fault, kind of.
Kind of, yeah.
Like, he just, like, you know something's weird. Why would you use the kid to suss it out, you know?
She's a little hesitant, but then she's like, yeah, sure. Why don't you come in, virginal soul?
And they're like, hey, why'd you say that?
That's a strange way to put it. So, I don't know, they're hanging out or playing or something, and at some point, inevitably, Pac's like, I need to use the bathroom.
You need to go pee in your sink.
She's like, you really want to use the bathroom, huh? So she leads him to the bathroom, and he sees the monster, and he starts crying. This was pretty rough.
So horrible.
And she just, like, pushes the kid inside and closes the door and, like, stands against the door. And this is so cool because we don't see a freaking thing. It's just sound. And somebody, some crew member, is pushing against the door, right? And this actor is amazing. Like, she's scared, yeah. And she's, like, you know, hesitates for a moment. But no, she's going to go through with it. Because this is going to mean, in her mind, that her husband's going to come back. And yeah. That's what she really wants. And so she has to, but it's horrible.
So, because the scene, like, you're right, we don't see it. But there's a brief shot, like... Because it's just like picture perfect in the worst way of like, we don't see her husband yet, but when he's looking into the bathroom, he's like crying. And this kid is also a great actor. Mm-hmm. He looks scared, you know, and he's like, no, like, please. And he goes in and then just kind of like turns around, or I think he like turns around and looks at her, and she then closes it on him. But then we see kind of the uncle or her husband in the corner, kind of like Blair Witching it. And then we see a shot from the back and the kid's just like crying, like just standing there frozen. And which I also think is a great direction, because like, what would it, like, he just is like, what do I do? And then we just see the moment where like he like jumps for him, and then it cuts to her, and it's so like, oh, so sad and horrible, but yeah, done very well.
So I was just thinking about this, like, you really don't need a whole bunch of money to make a good movie, so long as you have good actors.
Yeah,
I think that is really the key. But honestly, you could tell any story.
I mean, plays. They've been doing it forever. Like, they've been doing it with not a lot forever.
Well, I don't get this. I don't see this either. But it says, against Gao's instructions, Mui has removed the warding mask from Tong's face.
Yeah, I don't feel like we ever see her do that.
Yeah.
So
that sucks. So I don't remember seeing this at any point. Okay, back in Yao's house, in his apartment, there is this really cool thing on his wall, and it just like opens up, and it is something that the vampire, his father, the vampire hunter, used, and like it's all brown because it's got dried blood in it, and anyway, but it starts to like open. So Yao rushes to Gao's apartment, and he finds that Gao is mortally wounded. He's been hurt by Tong, who now is alive. And Gao confesses that Tong has risen as a Jiangshi and will haunt the apartment complex. Also, Gao is pretty fucked up because he has terminal lung cancer, and he has been smoking throughout this whole thing, of course. And but the ashes he's been smoking have been of unborn souls.
It's like, what?
I'm sorry.
Why? Oh, to stay alive, I think.
To stay like, alive, exactly.
And so, yeah, he's going to use this. I also don't understand. He's going to somehow use his, now the two girls' spirits, in the body of the dead husband to further his own life. I feel like they don't explain how that process was going to happen.
Yeah. But also, he killed Tong in the first place.
Yeah.
Because we saw Tong fall down the stairs and like crack his neck and his, you know, like his teeth got all fucked up. But he wasn't dead.
They weren't fucked up yet, actually. Like the teeth got fucked up after.
Okay.
Yeah, which is even more like, damn, you mute, like, you, like, even if he had died in that moment, now, which he hadn't, but it's like, now you've mutilated his corpse, kind of, for no reason. It's horrible.
So Gao, Gao threw Tong over.
So that he could use his, because he wanted his soul to further, to extend his life.
Okay. That's a little confusing.
It's very, yeah. Well, I only know that because I read the wiki. Like, I'm not saying I gleaned this myself.
Well, okay, so Gao explains that he is terminally ill and he had planned to bind the twin ghost's soul in Tong's soulless body to gain power and extend his own life. By removing Tong's mask, Mui has let the Jiangshi run amok. Okay, this is a problem with the movie because we don't see that happen.
Yeah, and why would she do that?
So Yao alerts Qin, who rushes off to find Yang. So Yang is searching for her son, Pak. And
I do love this scene of like her with the bell. Like, yes. I guess she called her son with a bell, but it almost like, I guess this must be another folklore or something, because I imagine this was so, like, a woman lost, ringing a bell looking for her lost child, like, seems like such a setup, you know, for, like, the spookiest story ever.
Yes. Right, so that's what she's doing. So she comes across the cabinet, and she you know, she rings the bell and there's knocking from inside the cabinet. So she opens up the cabinet thinking that Pac's inside and the twins escape. They're invisible at this point and they're just kind of following her. And there's that cool, really cool shot where she's just still searching.
I love this one.
Like she's opened up this cabinet. Nobody's in there. And then she like turns away and the ghosts are like right on her ass.
Yeah. The acting in this is so great. Like that, you know, she's just right behind her. And like the one ghost girl, she's so good at doing those creepy movements. Like that was, that's like some shots in this movie and some ideas are so good, but it gets so convoluted and doesn't explain itself, I feel like, fully. Maybe it's just something I'm not gleaning, but it's like, I do like this movie though. There's so many great shots and like the setting itself is so gorgeous.
Yeah. Oh, I agree with you. So Yang finds her son, but then realizes sadly that he is a ghost. So now she tracks down the Zhangxi and attempts to destroy it. Using, I don't know what.
It's like a giant piece of plywood with a bunch of nails in it.
Yes, right.
That she drags around first like a badass.
Yeah. But this fucker is strong and she is not. And so, you know, like he lifts her up by the neck or something like that. There's this great shot where she is just like hoisted up and she's killed. Then Chin arrives and sets the Zhangxi aflame with a Molotov cocktail, but this doesn't do very much either. And so the Zhangxi crashes into a store of rice and is immobilized. However, the twin ghosts appear and eagerly possess Tung's corpse. Revived, the powerful ghost-infused Zhangxi easily impales Chin through the stomach with a pole and leaves him for dead.
That part is so gross because he's trying, like, the pole is so long. And so he's trying to pull himself off, but then just falls all the way back down. It's so gross. But done so, like, this actor is amazing. Like, he looks like he's impaled.
Yeah. Really good. Like the actors in this have, like, really good physicality.
Yes.
So Yao finds him. And Yao is like, you know, just like, you know, rips his shirt apart and like breaks his fingernails so he can have some blood and like writes this like protection spell on his skin. Ooh, I love that.
Yeah, that was so cool.
More of that, please. That was so cool. And then he's also like mopping.
That was so awesome.
Chin has left all this blood in his wake, like on the floor. And so Gao's like, bet. I never say that. That's the first time I've ever said that.
I think you used it right.
I think so. I learned by watching you. He takes a mop and he starts like writing a protection spell on the floor. Oh my God.
That was so cool.
So cool.
Yeah. And they show like an overhead shot of the whole thing. And he's just like going to town. It's amazing.
It's the best. All right, so Yao sets a trap that temporarily binds Tung to the location, and that's going to allow Chin to fight Tung. But there's a catch. There's always a catch, right? He only has the time of that it takes to smoke a cigarette. Once this does, this is so Chinese. That is like the most Chinese thing I've ever heard.
It's so awesome. It's like he holds it up like you got this long. And this guy's been smoking the whole movie.
Yeah.
And it's just, it just hits the note so well.
So there's a fight scene that ensues. And while this is happening.
Why can you explain what the whole thing was of him holding it and then his arm twisting? Like, I couldn't. I was like, wait, why is this happening?
Yeah.
I was so alarmed. Like, wait, what? Why?
Yeah, Yao has the wonderful, like, Vampire Hunter wheel. and he's got to like hold his finger in the wheel, but eventually his arm gets like completely like twisted all the way off his body. But also the coolest part, I thought, is when he's fighting Tung or the Jiangshi, and it looks like they're fighting in wet concrete.
Yeah.
Oh,
that was really cool.
That is so fucking cool. And anyway,
there was also an amazing scene where I believe the actor must have been underwater, but at one point they show Tung and like he's just kind of walking, but he's clearly underwater, and it's just like, what? This is awesome. It was amazing.
Chin also is shown like underwater a little while later. Anyway, the cigarette, you know, burns all the way down, and everybody falls out of the window, but they're falling into sunlight. So Tong catches a fire and they all fall down together. So Yao, Chin, and Tong all end up in this courtyard at the bottom. And as Tong crumbles to ash, his humanity briefly returns when he witnesses Mui slit her own throat with a shard of glass.
Like, girl, I'm not trying to be rude, but if you were just going to do that in the end anyway, could you not have put everyone else through this?
Well, as we'll see in a second, none of this actually happened.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. And I think Yao, one-armed Yao now, is, like, smoking. It's like, of course.
So he's got an arm left to hold a cigarette.
I don't know how he lit that cigarette. That would be rude.
With his foot.
Well, could be, because he's very flexible. So in the final sequence, the audience learns that Chin was actually successful in killing himself, and that the events in the film chronicles were created by Chin's dying mind in the process, leading to rigor mortis.
Okay.
In reality, the film's characters are people Chin passed on the way to the apartment. And they're just people. They're like, they don't have any special significance. Mui was a widow admiring a picture of the late Tung. Hmm. Yao is a neighbor who rushes in too late to save the hanged Chin. And at the morgue, Dr. Gao is actually the coroner, and he is asked to bring the body of Chin out so it can be identified by Chin's adult son.
This is knowing that this is like the real actor. Like, does this guy have kids? Because if so, that would be so weird if your dad just acted in a movie where he killed himself because you and your family left, and then you had to identify his body. Like, that would just be so like, hey, dad, don't act in that.
What if it was, like, an American, like, movie? Like I'm just trying to think of, like...
Oh, somebody, like, who the actor would be?
Like, Ryan Reynolds or somebody. Because it's, like, I mean...
Yeah, Blake Lively walks in to identify his body. Horrible.
Yeah, it's pretty grim, but, I mean... So it'd be interesting to see if the actor has kids.
Like, if you don't have kids, fair game.
Yeah. So each ghost in the film is based on a mythological Chinese ghost. The actor is a Dao Sigui, a lost soul who wanders aimlessly after a suicide by hanging. The old man is Zhang Shi, a vampire ghost. The old woman is a Gui Po, a ghost who means well and wants to help, but can take her methods too far. The twins are Nugui, vengeful spirits after suffering sexual assault and suicide.
My God.
The mother is a Di Fu Ling, a ghost eternally bound to a location that drove her to suicide. A lot of suicide in Chinese mythology. Actor Su Ho Chen wanted to appear looking tired in the movie, so he requested to be awakened before every third hour after sleeping To prevent him from hitting a REM cycle, director Juno Mock made the first call to his hotel room to wake him up every day.
Talk about method acting. I mean, like, as long as he wasn't, man, that's too much. Don't suffer. Don't make your health suffer. Though he did look pretty tired, so he was successful.
Actors Anthony Chan, Su Ho Chin, Richard Ang, Fat Chung, and Billy Lau all previously starred in the original Mr. Vampire film franchise. The tall ghosts across the hallway... Oh, I didn't mention this part. That was a very cool shot. The tall ghosts across the hallway carrying parasols are based on Chinese reapers. Three variations include a reaper that returns a soul 7 days after they die to home. They return the soul to their home to say goodbye to loved ones before being taken to hell. Reapers that collect the lost soul that has wandered for 7 days. A reaper on the hunt for wandering souls that they trap in their parasol. It is used as a net. This is where the superstition originates, that you must not open one indoors should it contain a ghost.
Interesting.
What does Letterboxd have to say about it? Andrew GB79 gave it 5 stars. Excellent homage to the Mr. Vampire series. And it's not just a retread of the classic elements. Instead, it's a modern, darker take on the material. It looks great, and the visual effects are, for the most part, superb. The story meanders a touch too much to start, but when it focuses, it becomes surprisingly creepy and effective. Maybe I'm overrating this, but I thought it was a fantastic... Sorry. Maybe I'm overrating this, but I thought it was... fantastic as both a nod to and an updating of the golden age of Hong Kong cinema.
I gotta watch these Mr. Vampire films.
Me too. Breadlet 23 gave it 4.5 stars. A traditional Chinese take on the term vampire, extremely different from our westernized versions of what a vampire is, this version actually made so much more sense. The cinematography and attention to detail is truly beautiful, and learning about the Chinese traditions and folklore that revolved around this movie was eye-opening. And the makeup! OMG! I definitely recommend it. I really enjoyed it. Israelatin gave it 4.5 stars. A roundhouse kick to the face. Goddamn spectacular. But... Wolfwood gave it 1 star. Beautiful production design and absolutely worthless storytelling. What a waste!
I wonder, like, if you had seen all the Mr. Vampire movies, it would be more forgiven, you know? Any sort of, but it does, as somebody who's never seen any of them, I was very confused. And also, at the same time, I do not know any Chinese mythology, so, like, that, I feel like that definitely would maybe illuminate some things more.
Mm-hmm. Jeff17 gave it 1.5 stars. Disclaimer, I watched this in Hong Kong in Cantonese. The review is a quick one that I wrote while commuting. A frightless, plotless, squandered effort of an otherwise potentially exciting / intriguing concept that could have revived this nostalgic genre for the Gen X / Yers. The director Juno Mock was more interested in imageries and fancy angles that serve no reasons, rather than a solid story and plotting. Bless Mess gave it 1 star. A mess that prizes its special effects over virtually everything else that makes a movie watchable. It may be fun to look at occasionally, but it stretched pure visual appeal well past the point of breaking.
Damn.
What phobia is that? Basophobia is fear of falling. And ablutophobia is an irrational fear of bathing or washing.
I think I had that when I was a kid.
You did.
Were you just waiting to say that? I used to, like, I remember one time I just turned the shower on and then put my head under the sink. And then I came out and you were like, get back in there.
I don't remember that at all. But no, the year you were 3, you were afraid of dogs, bugs, and baths.
Anxiety will get you.
It sure will. You're an anxious little guy. All right. Well, let's rate this in terms of coins.
3.5 again.
Really? I'm surprised you are rating it that highly.
I really liked it. Like, I feel like I feel like the same can be said of both movies, of like, there are pockets in this movie where I'm like, ooh, chef's kiss. This is so amazing. And then there's some points where I'm like, meh, meh, you know, and it feels like a shame because the other parts are so good. So I didn't hate it, but I wouldn't say I like loved it. But it's one of those movies where like I'll rewatch some scenes and I'll be like, man, this movie's great. But then if you watch the whole thing, you're like, I don't know about this one.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's good. 3.5. Because, I mean, the fighting in concrete, fucking hell.
Amazing.
Gorgeous. The putting the protection spell in blood on the dude's chest.
Sick.
Every movie should have that.
I don't care what the plot is. Get me a mop and a bucket of blood.
Rom-com. I don't care.
And get that guy to do it.
Oh, for sure. What have we learned?
Honestly, I don't know. Like, I,
life is hard.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, we're all gonna die. You know what gets me, or what actually I feel like, is, I think, a positive message. Is like, you're going to die anyway. It will happen. So just let it happen when it happens, you know. Get live to that point, you know. If life seems too hard, it's going to happen anyway. So you might as well take all your time, I think, that you got.
Yeah. Probably. I mean, we don't really know what happened to the actor's wife and child.
Yeah.
They did not die. They left him.
Yeah, so it's like, you're also trauma, giving them the worst day of their life, you know?
I've already, spoken on this at length on this podcast about my feelings. Like, I don't care. If you're a parent, that's just simply not an option for you.
Yeah.
It's just not. Don't do that.
Yeah. And there's a great song from the Beetlejuice musical, where all these ghosts, you know, are trying to tell Lydia to not die, because they're dead, and they're like, "Dog, life is short, but death is super long." Such a good line. And yeah. Then the one ghost goes like, "Nietzsche was right, you know, to live is to suffer, bro." I love that line. And they're just saying like. Happiness is what you make. Like, you have to work for it, you know? So, and that they wish that they knew that when they were alive. And I feel like that's actually a genuinely good message. It gives me some hope and spirit, I think, to kind of be like, okay, you know, you got to work at it. It's not just going to happen to you. So you'll never know what you could be missing.
That's really deep. Would we watch it again?
I would.
Yeah, I would watch it again.
I'd watch it with you. We should watch it together. Okay, it might be more fun to watch it with a friend, you know?
Yeah
than alone.
Sick scenes in it.
Sick.
Do you have a favorite sex scene or death?
I mean, I think like Tongue's death is actually pretty like upsetting, but in a good way. And the scene with Mui. Crying, I just, that really stood out to me as like a hallmark, like amazing actor performance. So I feel like that honestly is worth like 3 of the stars. Like that scene, it's so good.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, she's, oh my god. I mean, if she were played by somebody, I mean, they play by somebody else, it would not be the same movie.
Yeah,
to me.
I agree.
who wins the You Fool Award?
You know, the necromancer.
Yes.
Like, dude.
Don't do that.
Come on. You're smoking unborn ashes just to stay alive. It is your time. Your time is here.
Well, thank you, Matt, for having this conversation with me about these two films.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I was looking forward to it all day.
Me too.
Thank you, Wohos, for joining us for this episode and for all your support. It means the world of horror to us, truly. Next time, we're going to be closing out the year with a couple of retrospective shows, but we will be back in the new year with shows about... Oh, I didn't know that is.
Good thing you got the chart.
Cult / dinner parties, fantasy / magical realism, depression, scary friends, slashers. You get it, Wolves.
Awesome stuff.
Sick. Creepy dolls. We love you, Wohos. And don't go into the basement.